Well, the task I was given for today's conference was to talk about the heavenly good of earthly joys. And before I dive into the topic, let me give you a little bit of personal background about where I'm coming from on that particular topic. I've been listening to Pastor John do what he did last night for about 15 years, since I was in college. And what John did last night is what he's been doing in books and sermons and articles and conference messages for over 35 years. I mean, he's Johnny One Note. He's got one thing to say, and 8, 10, 20, 50 arguments for it. And so all through college, I can remember listening and reading as John unpacked Hebrews 11:6 and John 6:35 and Psalm 34:8 and Psalm 37:4 and 1 Corinthians 10:31 and all the other passages to say that God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in Him. And like many of you, that landed on me. God broke it open to me. I saw it and I said, that's true. That's absolutely true. And I knew it was true because I could see it for myself in the Bible. I could just see it was right there, plain as day, on the page, no problem, I'm in. Christian hedonism, count me in. But then the questions came, because Christian hedonism doesn't just solve the problem, the central problem of how the pursuit of God and the pursuit of joy relate to one another, it also creates problems. Like, if I'm to pursue my maximal joy in God, then how do I enjoy earthly things? Should I enjoy earthly things? If I'm increasingly satisfied in God alone, then should my delight in my wife and my kids and my Chipotle burrito diminish? Should they grow strangely dim in the light of His glory and grace? And so, that was my issue. That was after coming out of college, moving up here in 2005, being a part of the, what was then the Bethlehem Institute, now Bethlehem Seminary. Those questions were just live ones for me and my soul. What should I do? How do I relate my joy in God to the joy in the other things? And so I thought and I prayed and I read the Bible and I talked to people and I tried to answer those questions as best as I could, and the result was the things of earth. It was my attempt to press Christian hedonism into the earthly corners of life. But what I wanted to flag here was the context in which I wrote that book. I wanted to write a book that encouraged Christian hedonists to treasure God by enjoying His gifts. By enjoying His gifts. That would set me free to enjoy God in everything and enjoy everything in God. But I wanted to do so with all the stuff that those other three guys just talked about ringing in my ears. In other words, I wanted to write a book encouraging us to enjoy the things of earth with the call of self-denial live in my ears, and the call to unreached peoples live in my ears, and the call to suffer in my ears. Deny yourself, take up your cross, sacrifice in the cause of love, go to the nations, lose everything, maintain your joy. I wanted all of that, and then I'm going to write a book about how to enjoy Chipotle. Thankfully, I was here when I wrote that book, and so that was the air that I breathed as I tried to write that book about enjoying the things of earth. And I think, really believe this, I think that's the only safe air to breathe if you're trying to write a book like that. The first time I was going to preach the core message of the things of earth, about 4 years ago, I'd been asked to preach here at Bethlehem, and Pastor John had just preached the week before on why did God create the world, and talked about glory of God, supremacy of Christ, gospel of God's grace, all of those things. And so naturally I followed up with, why did God create the world? Fish tacos, Dr. Pepper, wool socks, and baseball. Those are my questions. He's got his questions, I got my questions. So I'm working on why did God create this world with all of those things, and I'm working on the sermon up on the fourth floor, and Piper walks by. I think he's getting his hourly Diet Coke with lime. It's about hourly, right? he's walking by, and I say, hey, come in here. I'm working on my sermon. I want to bounce it off you. So I give him the preview of the sermon. I'm telling him about integrated joy, enjoying God and everything, enjoying everything in God, and diving into creation and then going up to God in praise, and embracing the things of earth as a way of creating categories in the mind and in the heart for knowing God. And I'm all excited about it, and I'm getting ready to go, and I'm going, and he sits there and he listens and he goes, until you die. I got to rewrite the sermon. I mean, it's a very Piper thing to say. But the thing was, it was also a very true thing to say. It's a very true thing to say. And it was good for me in the midst of diving into the intricacies of this to have that ringing in my ears. And I went home and I remember how God set up that week. It was statements like that that were shaping how I was thinking and in my head. And not just statements, because as I was writing a book encouraging people to delight in their children, I was weeping with close friends whose infant son was dying. See? Delight in your children, and God's tearing your children out of your heart. As I'm writing a book about seeing God's fatherhood pictured and displayed in our earthly fathers, I'm doing so while my own father slowly withers away and dies of dementia. You know? So I just want to echo what John said last night. I added this last night because I just want to echo what he said. When we speak of our maximal joy in God, we have to do so in the light of unfathomable suffering. And when we speak of our delight in the things of earth, we do so in a world where we will lose them. So that's preface. Now, Christian hedonics. And if you saw the title, you probably thought I couldn't spell. But you're wrong. I can. There are a lot of ways I could have approached the topic. I could have done, I thought seriously about doing biblical. I've got some texts that are kind of my go-tos and go in there. But I'm in the midst of writing another book on C.S. Lewis. And so I've been living in Lewis for the last year or so. And few people have been as helpful to me on this question as Lewis. And so I'm going to draw today from Lewis, not about Christian hedonism, but about Christian hedonics. So hedonism, you'll remember, is the philosophy of life devoted to the pursuit of maximal pleasure. And Christian hedonism is the philosophy of life devoted to the pursuit of maximal pleasure in God. Hedonics, it's a Lewis word, refers not to the pursuit of pleasure, but to the science or study of pleasure. That's what he meant by it. He wrote an essay called Hedonics one time, in which, among other things, he encouraged us to attend to our pleasures, to distinguish them, to categorize them, to get the quality and the particular feel of distinct pleasure. So, for example, in The Four Loves, Lewis distinguishes between pleasures of appreciation and pleasures of need. So a need pleasure is the pleasure you feel when you have a drink of water after a hot day in the sun, or a hearty meal after a long day's work, or, and this is an example Lewis actually gives, the feeling of joy that you feel when a gas station appears at just the right moment on a long road trip. He talks about the hallelujah choruses that erupt when that need pleasure arrives. And he says the distinctive element of need pleasure is that it is always preceded by desire, hunger, thirst, hurry, and it dies, the pleasure dies in the fulfillment of it. The desire dies in the fulfillment of it. Once you've had the drink, you no longer want the water. Once you've eaten all the food, you no longer are hungry, and the hallelujah choruses die away once you've done your business. It's a need pleasure. Pleasures of appreciation, on the other hand, are not necessarily preceded by desire. They can surprise us. They're not preceded by hunger and thirst. So things like pleasant smells, you don't have to hunger for a smell. All of a sudden, the smell just hits you. Or beautiful sights. These are things we enjoy in their own right and not because of some need that we have for them. And because of that, they, in a sense, claim our appreciation by right. We feel as though they deserve to be enjoyed. It's not meeting some need. It's not like I have an empty belly and therefore I need to fill it. It's just this beautiful thing deserves to be enjoyed by me right now. And this is the starting point, Lewis says, for all of our experience of beauty. Now, making that distinction, need, pleasure, pleasure, appreciation, that's an exercise in hedonics, the science or study of pleasure. And the reason that Lewis thinks this is necessary is because the category of pleasure is too abstract to be of much use to us. In other words, we always experience pleasures as concrete. Every joy is a particular joy. It has its own quality, and the joy of quenching of thirst and the joy of a hearty meal and the joy of hugging your spouse are all pleasures, but they're different, and there's qualities about them that we ought to pay attention to. And so one of the aims of Lewis's writings is to make different pleasures imaginable to us, to help to capture that quality of the distinct pleasures and make them real to us. So for example, in that essay on hedonics, one of the thing that he does in most of the essay is talk about an experience he has while riding on a train through the suburbs. And he talks about the particular pleasure of, quote, seeing things the wrong way around, of seeing from the outside what is to others and inside. And so essentially what he means, that he calls this the mirror pleasure. And so it's the pleasure you take in other people's domesticities. It's when you're in a place that's massively unfamiliar to you. It's like another planet. It's totally foreign. And yet there's this realization you have that somebody feels completely at home here. And Lewis got a kick out of this. In fact, he goes so far to say is, I'm not going to tell you the assessment of the pleasure I felt on that train ride because you will think I was exaggerating. He won't tell us the degree of happiness. And so there's a distinct pleasure he had in this mirror pleasure. That's one. Or again, in another essay, he describes the particular joy he had as a boy when he went to the theater and he imagined the difference between the stage and behind the scenes. Like for him, when he was a boy, the idea of being able to sit high enough up in the balcony, like if you had a stage with a stage set, to be able to sit right up there in the balcony and to be able to see front stage and backstage at the same moment, he was like, if only they would let me go up there and sit. In fact, he talks about when he got older and he was invited to a play, one time they let him stand on the scaffolding and look out onto the outside, so everybody else, it looked like he was standing on a balcony, he's standing on a scaffold, and he just thought this was the greatest thing in the whole world. To come from dressing rooms and bare walls and to come suddenly into Aladdin's cave or the Darling's nursery or whatever it was, to become what you weren't and where you weren't, this was most enviable. That's what he loved. So he loved this distinction. And so he said, there's a particular kind of pleasure. I want to attend to that. And my point is not to get into the differences of those particulars, but just to note that Lewis wants to describe for us the particularity of our pleasures. He believed that God was a hedonist at heart, that God had scattered pleasures and merriment abroad. Screwtape one time says, God has filled his world full of pleasures. There are things for humans to do all day long without his minding in the least. Sleeping, washing, eating, drinking, making love, playing, praying, working. And if God has given us these pleasures from his right hand, Lewis believed we ought to attend and be awake to the particularities and details of them. He doesn't want to just tell us about pleasure in the abstract. He wants us to understand this pleasure. So think about, I don't know if you've read the science fiction trilogy, but in his novel Perelandra, the main character, Ransom, journeys to the planet Venus, and Venus in the story is unfallen. It's paradise. And so repeatedly, he's trying to capture different kinds of pleasures on Venus. So for example, he says, Ransom takes a drink from the ocean on Perelandra. And then he says, though he had not been aware of thirst till now, his drink gave him quite an astonishing pleasure. It was almost like meeting pleasure for the first time. Or later, he's walking through a forest. He smells some flowers. The smells in the forest were beyond all that he had ever conceived. To say that they made him feel hungry and thirsty would be misleading. Almost they created a new kind of hunger and a new kind of thirst, a longing that seemed to flow over from the body into the soul. Or then he comes upon a gourd, squash, a Perelandrian squash, Sam. And he said, it was like the discovery of a totally new genus of pleasures, something unheard of among men, out of all reckoning, beyond all covenant. For one draft of this gourd on earth, wars would be fought and nations betrayed. It could not be classified. He could never tell us when he came back to the world of men whether it was sharp or sweet, savory or voluptuous, creamy or piercing. Not like that was all he could ever say. Or then there's a time where he's walking through some trees and there's these particular Perelandrian trees that produce bubbles. Okay, these big bubbles, and they get big enough and then they pop and they sprinkle their juice everywhere. And so he walks through and he accidentally runs into one and it pops and it floods him. And he says, immediately his head, face, and shoulders were drenched with what seemed an ice-cold shower bath, and his nostrils filled with a sharp, shrill, exquisite scent that somehow brought to his mind the verse in Pope, die of a rose in aromatic pain. Such was the refreshment that he seemed to himself to have been till now only half awake. When he opened his eyes, all the colors about him seemed richer and the dimness of that world seemed clarified. And then a little while later, he eats a Perelandrian banana, essentially. The flesh was dryish and bread-like, something of the same kind as a banana. It turned out to be good to eat. It did not give the orgiastic and almost alarming pleasure of the gourds, but rather the specific pleasure of plain food, the delight of munching and being nourished. A man, or at least a man like Ransom, felt he ought to say grace over it, and so he did. Now, in each of those cases, what he's trying to do is to make these imaginary pleasures imaginable for us, to give us the particular quality of them. The gourd is not the same as the banana, and the banana is not the same as the bubble tree, and the bubble tree is not the same as the ocean. They're different. Now, why do this? At one level, why do this? Why would he think this is so important? One answer is simple. Pleasures and pain are both unmistakably real. Screwtape laments in Screwtape Letters that pleasures and pain give us, quote, a touchstone of reality. Real positive pleasures, particular pleasures, are a protection and a deliverance from worldliness. The world tries to pawn off vanity, bustle, irony, expensive tedium, triviality as pleasures. And in reality, these are parodies and corruptions of pleasures as God designed them. God's a hedonist. He invented pleasures. But when we talk of bad pleasures or worldly pleasures, what we mean is pleasures snatched by unlawful acts. It's the stealing of the apple that is bad, not the sweetness. There are no bad pleasures, strictly speaking. But what demons and our sinful nature does is to take legitimate pleasures and tempt us to enjoy them at times or in ways or in degrees that God's forbidden. And when they do so, they seek to make the pleasures unnatural, less like God himself. They encourage the confusion because if we accept the substitute, the worldly pleasures, those worldly pleasures build up a crust around our soul that keep us from engaging with God. And then genuine pleasures, real pleasures, particular pleasures enjoyed without guile, without regard for the approval of other people, those real pleasures puncture that worldly crust. A walk in the countryside, playing a sport for the love of the game, reading a good book, or even, Lewis says, reading a third-rate book with self-forgetfulness, all of these inoculate us against the twisted mockeries that dark powers offer up in their place. What's more, they have the ability to shock us awake when the dreary music of the world has lulled us into a stupor. That's why it's important to get particular, because we want the particular pleasure to puncture the worldliness that we live in, the fog. But that's not the only thing that's going on here. It's not enough to encourage people, for Lewis, to enjoy real particular pleasures. If our hedonics is going to be Christian hedonics, it has to be obedient to God, which means there must be some element of self-restraint and self-denial in our earthly enjoyment. So here's what Lewis does. In Paralandra, so he gives us a window into how Lewis thinks about it. So those intense pleasures I just mentioned, bubble tree, gourds, so forth, after each of them, Ransom, in the story, immediately desires to have another. So the first gourd filled his belly, he felt satisfied, but it was so intense that he said, I want to have another one. Even though the bubble tree had refreshed him when he walked through it, he gets the idea, what if I ran through like 10 of them at once and got that intensity tenfold? However, in each case, something inside him checks that impulse. And he says that to demand the same pleasure over again immediately after experiencing it would somehow be vulgar and wrong. It would be, quote, like asking to hear the same symphony twice in one day. Now, in an age of iPods and iTunes, that does not hit us the way it should, and I wonder what we've lost. But for him, there was a vulgarity in saying, let's hear the same song again and again and again and again and again and again and again. He calls it the demand for encore. This itch to have things over again, and he thought it spoils the pleasure that it wants to repeat. And so Ransom starts to think, why do I have that impulse, that check to do it again? And he wonders whether the itch for encore is the root of all evils. The itch to have things over again is the root of all evils. And he says, no, wait, Paul says that the love of money is the root of all evils. And then he says, but isn't money precisely the thing that allows us to say encore in a voice that cannot be disobeyed? Isn't part of the snare of money that it enables us to say again and again and again and again to all of the pleasures that diminish every time we demand to have them over? So, Lewis thought we can't say encore all the time. And this is how he thinks, one of the ways he thinks about self-denial. Lewis is clear about self-denial that pleasures, whether Paralandrian squash or earthly delights, are not bad in themselves. Christian self-denial, unlike the self-denial in other religions, celebrates the good even when it's denied. This is really important. Other religions say deny yourself because those things are bad. Christianity says deny yourself because those things are good. If you're denying yourself bad things, you're not doing self-denial. That's just sanctification. That's just holiness. Self-denial says this is a real good. Listen to Lewis. Marriage is good, but not for me. Wine is good. I must not drink it. Feasts are good, but today we fast. That's what Christian self-denial says. And this is the paradoxical, two-edged character of Christianity. And it flows from the fact God made a good world, but it's broken and fallen. And thus, as Christians, we have to order our loves, regulate our desires. We ought to love things in proportion to their worth. No more and no less. And the lust for encore is an expression of our fallenness. It's an attempt to treat a single good as if it was the only good. Instead of embracing the Solomonic truth that Jason unpacked, that there's a time for everything, a season for every activity under the sun, we refuse other different goods and pleasures in favor of the one that has enthralled us in this present moment. We gorge ourselves on one good and reject the other goods that God intends to give us, so that rather than allow God to give us a symphony, we insist on playing the same note over and over and over and over again, and it diminishes as we play. So, that's reject encore. But Lewis's rejection of encore, his insistence on self-restraint, also serves another purpose. By refusing to say encore, we create the possibility of another distinct pleasure, namely the pleasure of memory. This is really interesting. When Ransom, again in the space trilogy, visits the planet Mars, he discovers that the unfallen inhabitants there only make love for a few years out of their lives and their marriages. And so Ransom's puzzled by this. They're unfallen. So what's going on? He says, is lovemaking pleasurable to you? Oh, yes, very much. It's one of the greatest pleasures. Well, don't you want to have it more than just that little window of your lives? No. And then Ransom says, but so the pleasure that you get, you must be content just to remember it? You have it for that short period, and then you just remember it for the rest of your life? And his Martian friend says back to him, oh, a pleasure is full grown only when it is remembered. You are speaking, man, as if the pleasure were one thing and the memory another. It's all one thing. What you call remembering is the last part of the pleasure. When you and I met, the meeting was over very shortly. It was nothing. Now it is growing something as we remember it, but still we know very little about it. What it will be when I remember it as I lay down to die, what it makes in me all my days until then, that is the real meeting. The other is the only the beginning of it. You say you have poets in your world. Do they not teach you this? The real pleasure of meeting is the pleasure as it grows within us over time, as it makes something inside of us, as it makes us into something more. And so to demand the continual experience of the pleasure, the beginning, is to cut ourselves off from those subsequent pleasures that God intends to give. And this principle, that memory is the capstone of pleasure, is for Lewis one instance of Christ's teaching that a thing will not really live unless it dies. Has many applications. So here's a quote from Lewis. On every level of our life, religious experience, gastronomic food, erotic, aesthetic, social, we are always, listen to this, we are always harking back to some occasion which seemed to us to reach perfection. Setting that up as a norm and depreciating all other occasions by comparison. So many Christians, maybe you've done this, look back with longing on the bright days after your conversion or after some great spiritual moment, and we lament that those fervent desires have in some way, some measure, died away or diminished. Now, sometimes that diminishment is owing to sin. But Lewis says, not always. Lewis suggests that God intends those early intense passions to pass away. They were, in his words, the explosion that started the engine of the Christian life. But man does not live on explosions alone. What's more, God has built us so that we can't keep these explosions going. Our bodies will not suffer the intensity of thrills, even spiritual thrills, for long. Lewis says this is the law of undulation. Undulation is a fancy word for rhythm, rhythm-like, wave-like movement. And so here's Screwtape describing us. Humans are amphibians, half spirit and half animal. As spirits, they belong to the eternal world, but as animals, they inhabit time. This means that while their spirit can be directed to an eternal object, their bodies, passions, and imaginations are in continual change, and the result is undulation. Quote, the repeated return to a level from which they repeatedly fall back, a series of troughs and peaks. Periods of emotional and bodily richness are inevitably followed by periods of numbness and poverty. Undulation, for Lewis, is the natural bodily way that God regulates our desires. Self-denial is the supernatural way that we join God in regulating our desires. And as humans, we're sorely tempted to ignore undulation and seek to get maximum and repeated joy out of the exact same pleasures again and again and again and again. And because we do it, we miss the joy that God's trying to give us now. Here's Lewis again. It's simply no good trying to keep any thrill. That's the very worst thing you can do. Let the thrill go. Let it die away. go on through that period of death into the quieter interest and happiness that follow, and you will find that you are living in a world of new thrills all the time. But if you decide to make thrills your regular diet and you try to prolong them artificially, they will all get weaker and weaker and fewer, and you will be a bored, disillusioned old man for the rest of your life. So instead of being tormented by the lost golden moments of our past, Lewis encourages us to accept them as memories. And when we do, we find that they are entirely wholesome and nourishing to us. Properly bedded down, this is Lewis again, in a past which we do not miserably try to conjure back, they will send up exquisite growths. Leave the bulbs alone. The new flowers will come up. Grub them up and hope by fondling and sniffing to get last year's blooms, and you'll get nothing. The past joy must die if the new one is to live. So, Christian hedonics, as I'm talking about it from Lewis, will attend to the diversity and particularity of pleasure, the siren song of encore, and in so doing, open the way for the distinct pleasures of memory. Lewis's friend Barfield once wrote, Owen Barfield said, "Each experience, each great experience is a whisper which memory will warehouse as a shout." Each experience is a whisper which memory will warehouse as a shout. It's not enough for us to remember the bare facts, however. Remember what the Martian said about poets teaching us this truth. For Lewis, we must capture and condense these pleasures into words and poems, stories and songs, and thus we see how Lewis's view of memory and pleasure dovetails with one insight about praise. Maybe you've heard this one about praise, okay? "Not only is pleasure not full-grown until it's remembered, delight is incomplete until it's expressed." Follow me here. Lewis is wrestling with the question of God's demand for praise in the Psalms. He's troubled by the fact that God seems to crave our worship, just the same way that an old woman craves compliments. And he knows God doesn't have any needs. And thus, why does God demand our praise? And then he realizes the obvious fact that all enjoyment spontaneously overflows into praise. The world rings with praise. Lovers praising their mistresses. Readers their favorite poet. It's hard for me not to hear this in like Piper's voice from like 2002, something like that. Walkers praising the countryside. Players praising their favorite game. Praise of weather, wines, dishes, actors, motors, horses, colleges, countries, historical personages, children, flowers, mountains, rare stamps, rare beetles, even sometimes politicians or scholars. Not only do men praise what they value, they urge us to join them in praising it. Lewis realized that in objecting to the praise of God, he was denying to us the very thing that we always do and can't help but doing with everything else we value. And he was doing so in regard to the most valuable being in the universe. And so this leads him to his final realization about the relationship between pleasure and praise. "I think we delight to praise what we enjoy because the praise not merely expresses but completes the enjoyment. It is its appointed consummation." So, let me just tie that in together. For Lewis, there's an art to pleasure, even earthly pleasures. There's a music of joy, a poetry of delight, and like poetry, everything has its place. The pleasure passes into memory. Memory forms itself into poetry. Poetry erupts into praise. "The most splendid line," Lewis says, "becomes fully splendid only by all the other lines after it." Again, this is Solomonic. There's a time to enjoy, a time to remember. A time to be pleased, a time to praise. There are rhythms of pleasure, and they are essential to the Christian life. And if we attend to them, if we indulge ourselves and then deny ourselves, we discover that there's a joy, capital J, that runs through all of them. Our enjoyment is completed and enhanced by remembering, and our pleasure is enlarged and consummated by our praise. Now, thus far, I'm mainly talking here about earthly pleasures. Okay, that's the main thing. That's all. When Lewis has been doing this, he's talking about those earthly enjoyments. But whatever we say about all of the different kinds of earthly pleasures, Lewis will not let us confuse them with joy with a capital J. They may be, those earthly pleasures may be the occasion for joy with a capital J, but they're never identified with it. Joy is a massively important phenomenon for Lewis, of the capital J, joy. Surprised by joy, that kind of joy. He calls it by various names, joy, Sehnsucht, good German word. Romanticism is where he talks about it at one point, but each of these is misleading, so I'm just going to talk about joy, but when I say it, think capital J, not little lowercase p pleasures. Joy, as distinct from pleasure, is an experience of intense longing with two distinct qualities. The first is that it is a pleasing pain, an absence that is more wonderful than any presence, an unsatisfied desire that is more desirable than any satisfaction, a hunger that is better than any fullness, a poverty that is better than all wealth. Most of our desires long for fruition, right? With joy, we just want to desire and keep on desiring. We long for the unending, pleasing pain. Joy has the stab, that's Lewis's word. There's a stab, a pain, the inconsolable longing. Second feature. In experiencing this desire, we long for we know not what. The desire may be triggered by many things. For Lewis, imaginative literature, faraway hills, a title of a book, a smell, a strain of music, the memory of a cookie tin made to resemble a toy garden, that was one of his. These things are trigger it, but these are not the objects that we desire. They're merely the occasions of the desire. And we know this because even if we possess them, we listen to the music again, even if we got to those hills, even if we dwell on that cookie tin, we never possess the object of joy. In his writings, Lewis describes this in various ways. You want to go follow up? Go read Pilgrim's Regress, which is a allegorical account, rough account of his conversion. And in there, John, the main character, longs for a faraway island. And every time you see the faraway island, think joy, capital J. Pleasing pain, paradoxical longing. Surprised by joy? He calls it the bright shadow that flowed out of George MacDonald's fantasties, transforming all the common things and baptizing his imagination. In Paralandra, this is the way he talks, it's a homesickness, a chord of longing that is sharp, sweet, wild, and holy all in one. In The Problem of Pain, Lewis describes it as the signature of each soul, and this is important. It's different for each of us. Like if you don't see a cookie tin that's shaped like a toy garden and have the stab, that's okay. If imaginative literature doesn't do it for you, that's okay. Something will. There's this unappeasable want, the thing we desired before we met our wives or made our friends or chose our work, and we will desire it on our deathbeds when the mind no longer knows wife or friend or work. We've never possessed it. We've only longed for it. All, quote, all the things that have ever deeply possessed your soul have been hints of it. Tantalizing glimpses, promises never quite fulfilled, echoes that died away just as they caught your ear. But if they should ever become manifest, if there ever came an echo that did not die away but swelled into the sound itself, you would know it. Beyond all possibility of doubt, you would say, here is the thing that I was made for. And Lewis tells us that this joy, this longing, led him down many false roads and rabbit trails, right? He wanted to find, where's all the joy coming from? And he looked to sex, and he looked to beauty, and he looked to music, and to literature, and to philosophy, and he never found anything on earth to satisfy this desire, but instead of leading him to despair, it led him to God. The quest for joy became for him what he calls a lived ontological proof of God's existence. What he meant was this. It's the argument from desire. You've heard it before, probably. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. And he employs this all the time in his writings. He tries to rip open this inconsolable secret in his audience in order to draw them out and say, it's for God. That's what you're longing for. Let me awaken it in whatever ways I can so that you can know who you were made for. Now, we could leave the subject aside here. In fact, this is precisely in his autobiography. He gets there and he says, I was looking for joy and I found God. I was looking for joy. I was looking for joy. Where's the joy coming from? Where's this longing supposed to end? And he found God. And then he says, it was less important to him. He still had those joys even after he became a Christian, but they didn't matter as much to him. This is a talk on the heavenly good of earthly joys. So we want to connect them. So follow me here. This is the final thing. Pleasures are distinct from joy. Pleasures, what we talked about in the first, all the particular things, attending to the differences of the kinds of pleasures in our lives and singling them out, Christian hedonics, those are different from joy, but they're not unrelated to it. In a passage from Letters to Malcolm that has shaped me as much as any other in Lewis, probably, he unfolds how simple pleasures, earthly joys, may become occasions for the adoration of God. And I wrote a book about it, so I'm just going to do the brief summary here. So here's how he does it. So begin with the simple, unchanging, absolutely unique glory of God. Just start there. God is completely and absolutely himself. His glory is completely and absolutely itself. It's one of a kind. There's nothing like it. Nevertheless, we give different names to that glory whenever it touches our various faculties. So here's what he means. When God's glory touches our wills, we call it goodness. When God's glory touches our minds, we call it truth. And when God's glory strikes our senses, we call it pleasure. Pleasures are shafts of the glory as it strikes our sensibility. And as a result, any pleasure, no matter how simple, can become a channel of adoration. Here's the quote. We can't, or I can't, hear the song of a bird simply as a sound. Its meaning or message, that's a bird, comes with it inevitably. Just as one can't see a familiar word in print as merely a visual pattern. So you can't, none of you can look at that right up there and see anything other than Bethlehem, education, and serious joy. The reading is as involuntary as the seeing. When the wind roars, I don't just hear the roar, I hear the wind. In the same way, it's possible to read as well as to have a pleasure. Not even as well as. The distinction ought to become, and sometimes is, impossible. To receive it and recognize its divine source are a single experience. This heavenly fruit, and what he's talking about, just so you can back up, he's talking about putting his hand under a cool stream on a hot day. That's the pleasure in particular he's talking about. This heavenly fruit is instantly redolent of the orchard where it grew. The sweet air whispers of the country from whence it blows. It is a message. We know we are being touched by a finger of that right hand at which there are pleasures forevermore. There need be no question of thanks or praise as a separate event, something done afterwards. To experience the tiny theophany is itself to adore. So, to experience it is to adore. Now, what keeps us from experiencing it? So that's, now we're going to try to bring them together. Lewis gives four answers. What keeps you from experiencing simple pleasures as channels of adoration? Number one, inattention. We ignore the presence of God everywhere. We fail to see that every bush is a burning bush. Second, the wrong kind of attention. We subjectify the experience. We look inside, trying to find the internal working and see if we can find it there, and therefore we lose it because we're not looking out there where it is. Third, greed. This is encore again. We demand the exact experience. We shout encore. We forget that all of space and time is not enough for God to utter himself even once. And yet we want to have it again already. Fourth, conceit. We take pride in our ability to find God in the little things. take pride in it. I can find God everywhere. And we forget that those who are looking down their noses at others are never able to see someone who is above them. For Lewis, the quest for joy, launched by his early unbelieving experiences of longing, led him down many false trails and almost left him disenchanted. But then he thought he discovered that the promise of joy was an optical illusion. It was a mirage. It wasn't real. There's a dead end. It's not real. But then in finding God in Christ, Lewis became re-enchanted. He realized that the universe was not a fraud. Earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy the ache in our souls, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. Thus, we then must avoid the twin errors of ingratitude and idolatry. We must not despise the earthly gifts which awaken joy, but neither must we mistake them for the something else of which they are only an echo or copy. Instead, we must be alert and awake to pleasures, earthly ones, while also embracing the necessity of self-denial and governing them. And so when God gives us earthly pleasures, what do? Here's the practical takeaway. When he gives you the pleasures, which he does, I'm hoping I help you eat lunch better today. We must say thank you for the gifts. How good of God to give me this. But we can't stop there. Then we must labor with God's help to adore him, to run our minds back up the sunbeam to the sun, saying, "What if this is how good of God to give me this?" But wait, what must be the quality of this being whose far off and momentary coruscations are like this? If this is this good, what must he really be like? Christian hedonics, the science, the study of pleasure, leading to Christian hedonism, the pursuit of our deepest pleasure, highest satisfaction in God through Christ. Let's pray. Father, there were so many different ways to tackle this. I'm not sure that was the right one, but I'm trusting you that it was. And so I pray, God, that you would help us to attend, to be alert, to have minds that are awake to your presence everywhere. You walk everywhere incognito. The world is crowded with you. And you've given us this world because that's the way that you create categories in our hearts and mind. You use earthly joys and earthly gifts to cut a channel in our souls, so that the joy in God can overflow the banks. So help us to be alert and awake and grateful, and forbid that we would ever stop under the sun, but chase them all the way back to the happy land of the Trinity, where we find our true home. In Jesus' name, amen.